And this morning we're talking about hope. About hope. Hope's another one of those words, isn't it? Like joy that we looked at last week. That gets used a lot at Christmas. But also it's one of those words like joy where there seems to be a big gap between the words on the front of the Christmas cards and what we actually see around us. Every time a new year comes around, people start off with great hopes and dreams, don't they? Of how things are going to be in the coming year, how things will get better. But now, when we've got to the end of the year, not many of those hopes and dreams seem to be realised, do they? The world seems to go on in just as much of a mess as it always has done. And maybe that's true of our lives as well. Maybe we have had great hopes and great dreams of our lives, but they never seem to quite come to pass. And so is there any hope of something better for our lives, something better for this world? To answer that question, it would be great to be able to see into the future, wouldn't it? That would be really helpful. If we could see where things were going, see where our lives were going, see where the world was going, we'd know if there was any hope, anything to look forward to, any future to get excited about. And the good news is that that's what chapter 11 of Isaiah here does for us. It gives us a blueprint, a plan of everything that God intends to do in this world. And it shows us that there is great hope to look forward to, a great reason to have hope for the future. This chapter starts in a situation where all hope has gone. It starts in a desperate place. The background, as we've been looking at over the last few weeks, is that the people of Israel, and they've begun to commit all kinds of evil. And so because of that, God has sent the Assyrian army to conquer them. The mighty Assyrians come down from the north as a judgment on the people. And they would go on to devastate much of Israel. They took the northern tribes away into exile, and they destroyed much of the land in the south. But God won't allow the Assyrians to completely destroy his people. Although he uses them as a way of judging the Israelites, the Assyrians themselves are proud and arrogant. They think that they've done it all themselves by their own might and power. And they don't recognize God. And so they too deserve God's judgment for their evil. So just look back into chapter 10 at verse 24. It says there, "Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty says, 'O my people who live in Zion, do not be afraid of the Assyrians, who beat you with a rod and lift up a club against you as Egypt did. Very soon my anger against you will end, and my wrath will be directed to their destruction.'" So the Assyrians are not going to last. And verse 33 of chapter 10 describes them like a great tree, but it's a tree that God is going to cut down. He's going to lop off the branches and cut it down. And so by the time we get to the end of chapter 10, the beginning of chapter 11, the scene that we're faced with is one of devastation. It's like a kind of forest that has been chopped down by a kind of slash and burn method. The northern tribes of Israel have been wiped out. The southern tribes of Judah are on their last legs. Assyria has been cut down. Everywhere that you look, there are these kind of stumps of kingdoms that were once great and now have been chopped off at the roots. There are no branches swaying in the wind, no birds flitting about, no sound, no life anywhere. And so it looks like a hopeless situation, doesn't it? What hope is there after all of that has happened? Is it all over? Is that it? Is there any hope? That's the position we find ourselves in at the beginning of chapter 11. But as we look carefully around this scene, as we come to chapter 11, there is a little hint of life. There is a little kind of flash of green down close to the ground. It looks grim, but there might be some hope after all. Have a look at verse 1 of chapter 11. "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. There is going to be some growth somewhere in this scene of devastation. A shoot is going to come up from the stump of Jesse. Jesse was the father of King David, the greatest king of the Old Testament. But his royal line has come to an end. They're one of the stumps. They've been cut down. Those kings have come to an end. But actually, that's not the end completely. Miraculously, out of this stump will grow new life. There will be a new king, a new David. David was the one who grew out of Jesse. Here comes another one, another David, a new king coming onto the scene. And this chapter 11 is all about this new king. It tells us what this king will be like and what kind of rule he will have. And it's with this king that hope for the world rests. So we're going to look this morning at what this chapter says about that king and about his reign. And then at the end we'll look at some applications for ourselves. So verses 1 and 2. The hope for this world is a new kind of king. Now imagine that you had to write a job description for a king. I imagine it's not the kind of thing that gets done very often. It's not really how kings are appointed, is it? By a kind of advert in the Maidenhead Advertiser. But if you had to think about what kind of person would make a good king, what would you write? What would you put in the kind of essential characteristics and the desirable characteristics of a king? Well, verse 2 tells us what this new king is going to be like. And as we read it, we're supposed to realise that this is the ideal king. This is everything we could ever want in a king. He ticks all the boxes of being a great king. First of all, he will be supernaturally equipped by God. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, it says in verse 2. And the fact that the Spirit of the Lord rests on him shows itself in numerous ways. First of all, he will have God's wisdom and understanding. He will know exactly what to do in every situation. He will never be unsure of the right way ahead, the best way. He will have God's counsel and God's power. That's related to his ability to do things. Often in this world, even when leaders know the right thing to do, they can't do it, can they? They're frustrated by politics or their rivals or by circumstances that they can't control. But not this king. He won't just know what to do, he'll be able to do it in every situation. And perhaps most of all, this new king will have the spirit of knowledge, it says, and of the fear of the Lord. Knowledge there is talking about knowledge of God, a relationship with God. And in fact, the beginning of verse 3 there says that he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He won't just use God as a kind of political tool when it suits him, as many leaders seem to do. His whole life will be characterized and shaped and driven by pleasing God, by his relationship with God. Now, you couldn't ask for any more from a king, could you? Imagine what this world would be like if every earthly ruler, every earthly king was like that, could be described in that way. This new kind of king is perfectly suited to be the kind of king that we need. And when the gospel writers tell us about Jesus, they make it clear that he is the one who is like this, that he is this kind of king. He fits the job description. Let me just give you a few examples of that, taken from the beginning of the Gospels. There are loads more. So Matthew tells us when Jesus is baptized that the Spirit of God came down and rested on him. Same kind of phrase that's used here. The Spirit of the Lord rests on Jesus. Luke tells us that even when Jesus was a boy, everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding. He had incredible wisdom, incredible understanding. And then when his parents wonder where Jesus is, he says, "Didn't you know I had to be about my Father's business?" You see, his delight is to serve God, his Father. And then immediately Luke tells us Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favour with God and men. And it's the same all the way through his life. Jesus shows supernatural wisdom in dealing with people, doesn't he? People are continually amazed by his answers, by his authority. He demonstrates his power to deal with things that other kings are powerless against, demons and disease and even death. Jesus is this new kind of king, the kind of king we need. And so when we read Isaiah chapter 11, we're reading about Jesus. We're have a great advantage over Isaiah in that he was looking forward to a king who would come. We can look back and see that Jesus is this king who Isaiah was looking forward to. Well, secondly then, what will the reign of this king be like? How will he reign? What would his rule be like? I'm sure we all know the saying, power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we remember it, don't we? Because we see it played out so many times in so many situations. From the kind of boss at work whose authority goes to their head, to people on the world stage. Somehow people who even seem to be well qualified to be leaders when they're not in power go off the rails when they're actually in power. So what about this king? He has God's power, absolute power. What will he do with it? Well, we see three things about his reign. First of all, verses 3 to 5, his reign will be a reign of perfect justice. One of the jobs of a king in the Bible is to administer justice. But however just a king or a leader tries to be, they can never be completely just, can they? And the reason for that is that they can never get all the facts and all the circumstances. They can never understand exactly what was going on and what was motivating people and what their intentions were. They're limited to what they can see or what they can hear from eyewitnesses. There will always be things that are impossible for them to find out. If you've ever been a parent of young children, you know, I think, just how difficult it is to judge fairly. You know that, don't you? You hear an argument developing in the next room, perhaps over who can play with a certain toy, and so you go in to try and sort it out and to bring a bit of justice to bear on the situation. And so you take statements, you find out who had the toy first, whether they put it down, whether they'd given the impression that they'd finished playing with it, what agreement had been reached earlier in the day about who could play with it next, what other toy they thought that they'd agreed to swap it for earlier. Even though the children perhaps are being completely honest, it's impossible, isn't it, to work out how to resolve that fairly and to do the right thing. Obviously, that never happens in our house, but I can imagine that would be a very difficult situation to be in. The problem is, you see, we can never have all the facts, can we? We can only rely on what we can see and hear. But this king is not limited in that way. Verse 3 says he won't judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. He has God's wisdom to know exactly how to deal with every situation. And so verse 4, that means that he can bring perfect justice for those who need it. Every wrong will be put right. There won't be anything left that anyone can feel aggrieved about. Everything will be made right. And no one who deserves to be punished will get away with it. All the wicked will get what they deserve too. His reign will be a reign of perfect justice. And secondly, his reign will be a reign of perfect peace. This is from verses 6 to 9. From time to time, in fact, fairly regularly, various crazy fads gain popularity, don't they, in the Christian world. Usually because someone's taken a few verses from the Bible and they've completely misunderstood them usually. They've written a best-selling book about how those verses are the key to living well and to their principles to be followed in our lives, and our lives will be better if we do follow them. The latest one is called The Daniel Diet. You may have come across that. It's claimed that to be healthy, people ought to follow a strict diet of fruit and veg, like Daniel and his friends did in the book of Daniel. Well, the fad that I'm really looking forward to is the Isaiah 11 Safari Park. I'm just waiting for someone to take verses 6 to 8 and suggest that they give us rules to apply to housing animals. That would be great, wouldn't it? Can you imagine driving through that safari park? You enter the wolf and lamb enclosure. There's a voice from the back seat. Daddy, I can see the wolves, but where are the lambs? Well, they are there. You just can't see them because they're inside the wolves. Daddy, can we go to the cobra petting zoo now? No, I think we'll just get an ice cream. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous to imagine that that could be the case. And the reason it's ridiculous is because we all know that those things are natural enemies, aren't they? If you put a goat in with a leopard, it wouldn't last 10 minutes. A lion is never going to settle down and eat straw. Ever since sin entered the world, wolves have been eating lambs, and leopards have been eating goats, and cobras have not made good pets for babies. But things are going to change, you see. When this new king comes, even those natural hostilities that seem to be fixed right into our world will change. His peace will be so profound that they will be forgotten about. He will transform the whole of creation and put right what went wrong when Adam and Eve sinned. It will be a new Eden, a new paradise. And of course, if even vipers change their ways, we can be sure that people are included, can't we? Hostilities between people will be over. Men and women will live in a right relationship with one another. Tribes and peoples who've been at war for centuries will live at peace. Verse 9 sums it up. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. And where is God's holy mountain? Well, the next line tells us it's the whole earth. The knowledge of God will spread everywhere. Everywhere will be a holy place where people worship God. This new king will bring a reign of perfect peace. So a new king is coming. His reign will be a reign of perfect justice, and it will be a reign of perfect peace. But thirdly, before we think about some applications, it will be a reign of universal glory. I don't know if you've ever been to a big sporting event or maybe a concert. I'm not a big sports fan. But once when we lived near Portsmouth, I did go to watch Portsmouth Football Club. They were in the Premier League in those days. And the crowds were quite big. We had to park a distance away from the stadium in some of the residential streets nearby. And as we made our way, as we walked down the streets towards the stadium, we were joined by thousands of other people, all heading in the same direction. Every side street that we passed, another kind of trickle of people would join in with the main crowd. Until as we got near the stadium, from every direction, there was a flood of people all coming together at the stadium. And the picture that we have here is a bit like this. It's a flood of people coming from all over the world to surround Jesus, this new king. Have a look at verse 10 there. In that day, the root of Jesse, talking about Jesus as we've seen, will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and in his place, and his place of rest will be glorious. Then look at verse 12. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. People will be streaming in to surround Jesus. And as they come, all their hostilities will be forgotten. Verse 13 talks about Ephraim and Judah's hostility being over. They were the big enemies at the time Isaiah was writing. And there also won't be any enemies left for God's people. There are a number of places named in these verses. Verse 11 mentions Assyria and Egypt and Cush and so on. And then in verse 14 we have Philistia and Edom and Moab and the Ammonites. And all of those people are the historical enemies of God's people. Back through the years, the people who have opposed God's people, who fought and defeated and oppressed them. But in verse 14, what's happening? Those places are being plundered. Their power is gone. The battle is over. And in verse 11, all of the God's people who've been held captive by those enemies are coming out and returning home. all the enemies of God's people are defeated, they're over. And instead, God's people are returning from all over the world to a place that's glorious. It's a home with Jesus at the centre and with people from all nations bowing down before him. His reign is a reign of universal glory that extends over the whole earth and to all peoples. And so this chapter gives us a blueprint of God's plan for the future of the world, a world where Jesus is king and where he reigns with peace and justice, and the nations come to worship him in his glory. Now, of course, at Christmas time, we celebrate, don't we, the fact that Jesus has come, that this king, Jesus, has come. But if he is the king that Isaiah is talking about, he seems to have failed, doesn't he? This world is a long way from the glorious vision that's presented here. And so what's happened? How do we explain that? Well, a way that it's often explained is by thinking about a range of mountains. If you imagine that you're driving, and ahead of you, a long way off, is a set of mountains. And from a long way off, the distance that you are, it looks as if all of them are roughly at the same distance. They're probably all kind of one range with various peaks in them. But as you get closer, you can begin to see that actually they're not all in the same place. Some of them are a bit further back in a range behind. Some of them are a bit closer to you. And it's a bit like that with these prophecies about Jesus. Isaiah was a long way from Jesus coming, 700 years. And from that distance, it looks as if the events of Jesus' first coming and his second coming both happen at the same time. That they're all one thing. They're kind of squashed together into one event as Isaiah sees it. But as we get closer, and especially now as we're after Jesus' first coming, we see that some of these things are connected to when he comes the first time, and some of these things will happen when he comes the second time, his second coming, in the future. But we see, don't we, when we read the Gospels, we see enough of what Jesus does in his first coming to be sure that he will do the things that have not happened yet. We can have confidence, can't we, that he is able to do those things. We see that he is able to defeat death, to conquer death, to make peace, to drive out evil, to repair broken creation, to calm the storm, to feed the hungry. All of those things. Jesus is clearly revealed as the one who can do the things that Isaiah says he will do. And so at Christmas, it's right, isn't it, that we celebrate the coming of hope into the world. Because Jesus has come, and because he has come, this picture, glorious as it is certain. The Christmas cards are not overdoing it when they declare that there is hope for the world because of the birth of Jesus. And so how should we apply this chapter to ourselves this morning? Let me suggest three things. First of all, our hope for this world depends on what Jesus will do. So rally to Jesus. Our hope for this world depends on what Jesus will do. So rally to Jesus. Did you notice as we read it that there's a phrase that's repeated over and over again in this chapter? He will. He will. He will. It's all about what he will do, isn't it? What Jesus will do. Everything that we read about in this chapter is because of what Jesus does, not because of what we do or of what anyone else does. At this point in Israel's history, everything else has failed. The people have been exiled, the land has been devastated, the kings have been cut off, the people are not where they ought to be. It's no good looking for help from any of those sources. The only hope is in this new king, is in what Jesus will do. He is the one who rules righteously, who brings worldwide peace, and through whom the worship of God spreads across the world. And so if we want to have lasting hope in this world, then we need to rally to Jesus, don't we? We need to surround Jesus, looking to other kings or leaders or technologies or educational policies or healthcare breakthroughs or relationships or our next purchase or whatever it is may work for a while. They may give us hope for a while, but in the end they will let us down. What will be left at the end, when everything else is gone, is people of all nations surrounding Christ. And if that's the case, that is the only secure place for our hope, isn't it? To be part of those people who come to Christ. Secondly, our hope for this world is glorious. So stick with Jesus. Our hope for this world is glorious. So stick with Jesus. This chapter shows us that the time is coming when all our enemies will be defeated. God's people will be freed from everything that keeps them captive. Every sin that you battle against, every pain and sickness and effect of ill health, every effect of your past that you can't shake off, every burden and fear and worry, all of those things will be gone. Freedom is coming. Our future is a gloriously transformed creation, with nothing left to make us afraid or to trouble us. So hang in there. Hang in there. Use this chapter to remind you what's ahead and to keep you going when times are hard. Our hope is glorious. So stick with it. Stick with Jesus. And then finally, this morning, our hope for this world is perfect unity. So love one another. Some of these verses from Isaiah are quoted in the New Testament in Romans chapter 15. Paul there is encouraging Christians who come from different religious backgrounds and cultural backgrounds to get along with one another, to accept one another as brothers and sisters. And to encourage them to do that, he quotes a verse here from Isaiah 11. It's verse 10. And Paul's point to them is that the root of Jesse has come. Jesus has come. And he has already begun to gather people to himself from every different country and nation and tribe. As the news about Jesus spreads across the world, people from all kinds of backgrounds come and enter God's family through him. That's reflected, isn't it, in our church family here. Even as we meet together this morning, we have people from all around the world, from a whole range of backgrounds, whole range of nationalities. And what Paul says to the Christians in Rome is that if what Jesus is doing is uniting people, well then we ought to be united, didn't we? As people who have come to Jesus, we share the same future, we share the same hope. We are one people. And so as one people, we should love and care for one another. We should be united as we wait for his appearing. Let's pray, shall we? Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for your kindness to us in giving us this view of what you intend to do in the world, this vision for the future, so that we're not left wondering and guessing how it will work out and who will come out on top. We thank you that your plans are certain and fixed, and they're glorious, a world of perfect peace and justice. And we thank you for blessing us in particular with helping us to see Jesus. Thank you that we live at a time when he has come once, and we can see that he is fully qualified to be this king, that he has all wisdom and all power to bring about what you have promised. And so we pray that our hope in this world will not be on anything that will pass away or fail, but our hope will be in him and in his work and in that glorious new world that he is bringing about. Amen.